The Coptimizer podcast is being powered by Axon Coaching. Axon Coaching was purpose-built for today's public safety employees to help them accomplish goals and live better. What is it, you ask? One-on-one video-based coaching with officers who have been in your shoes and know firsthand what it means to live and work in public safety. The program will connect you with certified coaches who combine their years of success from the world of law enforcement with world-class training from Axon. Get the support, resources, motivation you need to live the life you want. Axon coaches are relatable, knowledgeable, and confidential. And most importantly, they get results. Why should the keys to unlocking our peak performance be reserved for just the boardroom or the playing field? Unleash your full potential today and get started with Axon Coaching. Log into axon-coaching.com and learn more about how to bring this program to your agency and community. So, enough of that. It's time to Coptimize. Good morning, all. Welcome back to the Coptimizer podcast. I got another awesome guest today. Today's guest is Chief Gary Gasick from the Concord Police Department. Chief Gasick started his career as a youngster up in Milwaukee, and I'm going to let you hear him tell the story because I think it's pretty unique and unusual. So, Chief, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Patrick. This is my very first podcast experience. So welcome to 2005 for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to try not to disappoint you here. Current chief and an old chief on a podcast chatting. This has the potential to be riveting or catastrophic.
Yeah, exactly.
I really do appreciate you taking some time. We had a good conversation prior to getting set up for the show. And you told me that you started policing at the age of 17. And I just thought that was awesome. So 17, wow. I can't even imagine what, at 17, nope, wasn't ready.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to go to college, you know, the conventional route, and I also had an opportunity to join the Milwaukee Police Department as a police aide or a police cadet. And in Milwaukee, that's a full-time, uniformed, full benefits job where it's an apprenticeship for a few years before you can go into the academy at age 21. So for me, right out of high school, I joined. I was 17. I turned 18 about a month or so into my police aide career. So yeah, it was an early start, but it was a formulative experience those 3 years. And in Milwaukee, oftentimes those police aides ultimately end up later on in their careers being members of the command staff. So it's a really good program to immerse these young folks into the profession.
So when you say uniformed, so not armed, I take it, or were you
correct? No, correct. Not armed. So, you know, when I went through as a police aide, it was the exact same uniform as a police officer, minus the duty belt. You know, the badge is different. It was a smaller badge, I believe. You know, in the years since, they've gone to, instead of a navy blue uniform shirt, you know, a light blue, it's a little bit more clearly recognizable that the person's a police aide. I think they might even have a rocker over their shoulder patch that says police aide. But when I went through it, yeah, same uniform as a police officer, different badge, no duty belt, working inside.
So how much did you get paid? Do you remember? Or did it even matter?
Oh, I have no clue. But in 1990, I thought I was rich, you know, right out of high school. Those first few checks, I was like, this is awesome.
Well, I know even when I started at the PD where I worked at 27. So that was after the military and then after college, I still couldn't believe I was getting paid the first few years I was on the job. It was so much fun. So at 17, getting paid, working as a police aide, that had to be pretty thrilling.
Yeah. And, you know, I got to work in a few different police districts. I got to work in the jail. You know, that my parents used to joke when friends would ask, you know, how's Gary doing? You know, he's fine. He's still working for the, you know, police department. He's actually in jail now. You know, so they always figured I'd end up in jail. They just didn't know in what capacity.
Yes. Yeah. We're all on the same path, and it's the divergence in our choices that lead us either to working in the jail or being in jail sometimes. So of course, even with benefits, that's a pretty robust program. Of course, when you're 17, you know, who thinks they're ever going to need healthcare benefits? But you know, if you break your ankle or get busted in the chops, you know, that's kind of a nice thing to have.
Yeah, the great thing, and they've since changed this, but the great thing was that those 3 years as a police aide counted towards my creditable service towards retirement. So I was literally able to retire at the age of 42 and 11 months. And that's why I became a police chief, you know, in the summer of 2015 at the age of 43.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about your path then at Milwaukee PD. You are a police aide, and then you get hired as a police officer.
Yeah. So I was able to get into the academy. You know, the minimum age in Wisconsin is 21. So I turned 21 a week later, the academy starts. So I just barely slid into that particular academy class, went through the academy, pretty unremarkable, was assigned to a patrol district just like everyone else. And again, pretty unremarkable. You know, it's Milwaukee. It's you know, the north side of the city. It was district number 4, the northwest part of the city. And just the average, normal, you know, patrol duties in an urban environment. You know, you get a lot of experience in a very short period of time because the pace and the tempo is crazy. And this is, you know, at that time, 1993, we're still going through that whole, you know, late 80s, early 90s, you know, crack epidemic, you know, significant amounts of violent crime in urban areas. And so I got a good taste of that early on in my career.
You know, I've had a conversation with another chief, and we were talking about the same thing, and that sometimes I think people forget how busy police departments were in the 80s and early 90s, and the impact that the crack cocaine epidemic had on communities. And we had a nice long period of time, quite frankly, you know, from the late 90s, you know, up until 2015, where, you know, crime just steadily was on the decline nationwide. Violent crime was down in all of our major metropolitan cities for the most part. Yeah, those were busy days back there for police departments.
Yeah, and there's so many in the profession right now that just never got, you know, a taste of that experience. You know, and when we were coming on as new folks in the profession, it was the old salty, crusty, gray-haired veterans that thought that they had it rough, because these are the ones that went through, you know, the mid to late 60s and the civil unrest and everything that was going on at that point in time. And you know, then we experienced it in the late 80s and early 90s, and then there's been a lull. And then, yeah, since probably 2014, 2015 or so, we've started to see an increase in violent crime across the country. And obviously, the last couple of years, more of a significant increase.
So the opportunity to work a lot of those districts and in those times, it is a little bit of baptism by fire, especially you're a young officer. And a lot of times, you know, people, you know, they don't truly appreciate what that's like, you know, from an overload of the senses. Like you're taking in a lot of new information, you're learning a lot, and you're just trying to keep pace, and you're trying to perform at a high level at the same time. And that can be very challenging. So what was your academy experience like, and just like that formulative first year? Because, you know, having started at 17, by the time you start at 21 and go into the academy, you've got a really good base of knowledge about how police operations work. You've got relationships that are formed inside of the organization. So for the 21-year-old or 25-year-old or 30-year-old that's starting day one, they're not in that same position.
Exactly. And that's a huge advantage for the police aid going into the academy. Now, Milwaukee runs their own internal academy. I believe we started with a class of 66 individuals You know, we already had developed relationships. We know how the department is organized. We already have contacts. We have, you know, some of us had developed mentors at that point. The things that you were covering in the academy are things that we've already either done or experienced it or have read about. So it was just easier academically. Physically, it's the same for everybody, right? But, you know, I'm a 21-year-old in relatively decent shape at that point. So the physical aspects of the academy were not too difficult to get through. But we ended up having a lot of great individuals in my academy class. In fact, one of them ended up becoming the police chief not that long ago. He's since moved on, had at least one assistant chief, several members of that academy class, you know, ended up in a command staff level position. So a lot of talent. You know, I know one of them was with the department for a short period of time. And now he's the chief in Aurora, Illinois. You know, he didn't stay with Milwaukee all that long, Keith Cross, but he was there for a short bit and then moved to an agency in Illinois. And right now he's the chief in Aurora. So just a lot of talented folks. And you know, when you surround yourself with good folks, it makes getting through that academy process easier because we're all working as a team academically and physically.
And I think that's a good plug for organizations to think about those types of programs, the Police Aid, Police Explorer. And it might be one of the solutions that we're looking for in this current crisis that we're in. And I call it a crisis because everywhere I go, when I'm talking to chiefs and commanders, they're having such a difficult time recruiting and retaining talent. And we're not bringing in the numbers that we used to be able to bring in. So, you know, when you're really looking to try to build for the future, starting with that youth type of program, I think really it assists in several different ways. One, it helps you identify good talent and people that are, you know, that have the right aptitude for the job, but also, you know, you're just starting them on that training path. So when they do get there at 21, 25, they're in a better position because I know even for myself, 21, I was in the military. I was a security police in the Air Force. But that was so much different than what it's like to police out on the streets, you know, in an urban environment. So, you know, we get into these discussions all the time. What's the right age, right? Is it 21? Is it 25? Is it 30? And, you know, I've pretty much come to the conclusion that the age is irrelevant. Really, it's about the individual and life experiences and, you know, their maturity level and what they're prepared to really sacrifice to make sure that they're successful.
Yeah. And if you look at it too, folks can do a lot of things at the age of 18. You know, they can vote, they can serve in the military, they can do a lot of things. And I think that when we are up against the hiring and recruiting situation that we're in and that we've been in, we need to start looking a little bit more creatively in terms of how do we increase the size of the pool of applicants that are available to us. You know, departments across the country have relaxed drug testing standards, you know, pre-hire, they've relaxed, you know, tattoo standards and things of that nature. So I'm not aware of any agencies across the country that have been able to lower the age in the last few years. My assumption is that something that has to be, you know, approved at the state level, you know, through legislation, but something that I think agencies probably ought to be looking at in some way, shape, or form is what is a minimum age that would allow folks to get into this profession. Obviously, at the age of, you know, 16, 17, that's ridiculous to think that's the case, but, you know, 18, 19, 20, you know, you're starting to look at them being on the borderline of being able to do the job of a police officer. Like you said, it's up to the individual. What kind of training do they get? And are they capable of doing the job and making the right decisions at that age? One of the things that we're doing here that I would suggest agencies, if they're not already doing it, is really trying to be as proactive as possible when you're recruiting. So we have a youth police academy program. So kids as young as 12 years of age are able to get into this one-day youth police academy. We have a week-long summer academy. It started out, the one day started out by taking individuals, you know, from the ages of 12 to, let's say, 16 or 17 that really didn't like the police, that didn't trust the police. I've got SROs in every public school in the city of Concord. And I asked those SROs to reach out to the kids that you know aren't huge fans of the police and get them and get their parents to allow them to spend a day with us. And let's see whether or not at the end of the day, we can change their attitudes about who we are, what we do, and learning more about each other. And that was successful. And of course, when you advertise that type of a program, you're also going to get kids that have an interest in law enforcement. And so we get a group, a diverse group of individuals through that program. We turned the one day into a week long, and the week long is more of a deeper dive into policing. And that's more or less the folks that truly have an interest in law enforcement as a potential profession. So we're actually recruiting folks that proactively. I started a police cadet program a couple of years ago, right before COVID hit. And that is for folks aged 14 to 18. And it's similar to our police aid program in a way, in terms of, you know, the training that we offer. It's not, they're not employees. They're not, you know, hired or uniformed or getting any sort of benefits. It's a volunteer program, but we do put them to work at certain special events that happen in the city. And I'm proud to say that a couple of basic law enforcement training, which is our academy, a couple of academy classes ago, two of my cadets, we actually hired full-time to be police officers. So if you think about the proactivity of recruiting nowadays, we're hitting kids up as early as 12 and introducing them to the profession. And we're providing them an opportunity from the age from, you know, as early as maybe 14 or 15 through the age of 20 to be in our police cadet program. And when they turn 20, we're willing to hire them full time, put them through the basic law enforcement training program and hiring them full time. And that's what I think we need to do, is start making investments in our youth at a much earlier age than what our profession did, you know, a decade or two ago.
Yeah, that's a great, it's a great point. And what would your advice be to a chief who maybe wants to do something like this, but also recognizes that when you're in a manpower crunch and when you're running short, and every agency is going to be different. You know, the pace is just going to be different depending on, you know, whether you're urban, you know, in a major city, or if you're in a midsize, or, you know, more of a rural area. But there's a choice as an administrator that you're making in terms of how you're going to utilize your existing manpower. Am I going to take a sworn position or more than that and dedicate them to these community outreach type of jobs, where we're going to run youth academies, where we're going to run citizens academies, where we're going to get out and interact with the community? Because you have, there's always going to be an element inside the organization that says, why are we wasting our time there? We need to handle calls for service while, you know, Sergeant so-and-so is out, you know, kissing babies and shaking hands. I'm out here, you know, working the midnight shift, grinding away. Maybe you got that, maybe you didn't, but I think that's been, you know, one of those internal discussions that happens.
And this isn't taking anybody offline. This is all, you know, on overtime, on off days, and they're all volunteers. Like for the police cadet program, we initially started off with 31 police cadets, and it was a relatively competitive process where we took individuals that were primarily residents of Concord, North Carolina, or at least within the county. And we had 31 cadets, but we also had 22 police mentors. So these are SROs or other members of the department, sworn members, that basically take one of these cadets under their wing and mentor them and make sure that they're showing up to school and getting good grades and making the right life decisions. And even if ultimately that police cadet never really gets into law enforcement, you know, they're a third party endorser later on in life that knows exactly what we do, why we do it, and how we do it, and can speak intelligently to those that don't have that information that would otherwise speak disparagingly about police officers or the profession in general. So again, it's proactive. It's not taking away any resources from being able to answer calls for service. And to the extent that I have folks that are motivated to be involved in these programs, they too see the need to start recruiting folks at such an earlier age. They want me to hire good people. They want me to hire folks that are actually dedicated to the profession, because we've probably seen, I know I've seen it in my department, I've talked to chiefs all across the country, you know, back in the day when you and I probably started the career, we looked at it and we said, you know what, we're going to invest the next 25 to 30 years doing this job. Nowadays, it seems more and more common. Somebody becomes a police officer to scratch an itch that they have, to resolve a curiosity. And after 2, 3, 4 years, they're like, okay, I'm done. I'm going to go sell insurance now. You know, after 2 to 3 years, you just start to begin to be good at doing your job. So we really have to make sure that we're doing our best to identify those that are truly interested in and invested in a career in public safety. And if we can formulate that interest at the age of, you know, 16, 17, and 18, it's something we need to do. And it's not like we're focusing entirely on that youth recruiting. We're still doing all the regular conventional recruiting, but we have to start developing a pipeline, right? That's our single A or double A kind of ball club. You have to invest in that pipeline of talent that you can eventually end up hiring at some point. And you would hope, based upon our investment so early on, that there's going to be some level of loyalty that individual has to the agency that is going to hire them.
Yeah. Pay now or pay later. That's really what it boils down to. If you don't make the time and invest now, then you're really going to pay for it later, and probably not the ways that you want. Where, I think that's fascinating, and I hats off to you for having such a proactive approach to building for the future. And I know it's not like that in every community, and so when we have these, and I'm just having this discussion yesterday about recruiting, it's sometimes it's difficult, you know, the average tenure for a chief in the United States is 3 years. That's a very short amount of time. It's hard to build for the future when, you know, you're on such a, you know, a tight timeline. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Primarily, police chiefs are appointed positions, and that, you know, they're kind of subjected to the winds of political elections, and you know, whoever comes into office sometimes tends to, you know, they're going to want to bring someone that's aligned with the way that they think, and so sometimes chiefs get caught up in the middle of that, and so it's not unusual to see a chief work for 3 years, go back to being a commander for 4 years, come back to being a chief, and I think sometimes people are curious as to why that happens, but you know, good, bad, right, wrong, it's just the way it is. And so as a chief, you know, it takes some planning, takes some forethought, and it also takes a little bit of courage to make that decision, knowing that it may not be popular with everybody, but it is the right thing to do for the future of your organization. And quite frankly, for your communities, because that's where you're getting the diverse backgrounds and, you know, diverse mindsets. And the other part that I think can't be understated is that you're also in that program that you're referring to that you went through, that 4 years is a good amount of time. It's great exposure, and someone that really, you know, they're going to know by the time they get to be 21, 22, if that's the career path that they're really interested in pursuing. And it's not going to be that scratch the itch, like you said. And we won't have the amount of turnover, I think, maybe in the future, if we can set up programs like that. But
yeah. Well, we're not facilitating these programs in a vacuum. You know, the city manager's aware of what we're doing, the mayor and city council, they're aware of what we're doing, and they've bought into it. They understand the reasoning, the logic behind it, the benefits. So I trust that these types of youth outreach programs are going to outlast me after I'm gone. And I hope that they would. We've structured them in such a way that it's not necessarily dependent upon who the police chief is, but there's community support, elected official support. And so when you have that, these types of programs are supported, and they will likely continue.
Well, and it's just going to make you more effective as an organization, because when you've got those roots in your community, and you have those relationships that builds to higher levels of trust. When people trust their police department, they're more willing to share information. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where in the organization you're working, from first day patrol officer to veteran chief, you're in the information business, and the better information you get every single day allows you to make better and more informed decisions, whether it's a homicide you're working or whether it's a policy decision you're trying to make. It's all about information. So, which, you know, it may be a good time to segue, because one of the other things that you were talking about is because you had that experience at an early age, you got kind of a jump start on your career. So you're in the academy at 21, and that led to an early promotion. So can you tell me a little bit about how that went down and how you wound up being one of the youngest sergeants to be promoted in Milwaukee?
Yeah, so I was fortunate. I had a mentor early on, and this was he was a top commander. He was a full bird colonel in the Army Reserve, and there's two pieces of advice that he gave to me early on, and it stuck with me for the last 25 or so years. And the first is management 101. You never set your people up to fail, and never forget where you came from. And those things have, like I said, stayed with me, and they relate to this transitional story that I'll tell you about, how my supervisory career started with Milwaukee. So like I said before, I was the youngest sergeant in MPD's history, Milwaukee Police Department's history. And that's because the stars aligned perfectly. I got into the academy a week after I turned 21. My academy class was the last one that was eligible to take the sergeant's exam and the assessment process. And I ended up scoring first in that process, and I ended up getting promoted a couple of weeks later. So it happened relatively quickly. I was 25 and 4 months old at the time that I was promoted to sergeant. And at the time I was the youngest, and probably still am, because they've changed the amount of time that you need as a police officer before you can even test for sergeant. I don't know if that's changed and it's gone back down, but it went from 4 years to 5 years. So my first assignment was patrolling on a mid shift. We called it the power shift, which was 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. And my span of control was 18 officers, many of whom were disgruntled malcontents. And these mid shifts or these power shifts only ended up having one supervisor. And on that shift, it was me. And so one of my officers actually began his career 3 years before I was born. And I knew this in advance of taking that assignment, that one of these officers was on this job as a police officer 3 years before I was born. So you can imagine what I'm thinking going into this assignment, right? So I knew that this guy was an informal, but he was an influential leader on the team. And I knew that if he and I didn't click, my life was going to be miserable, right? He was going to undermine everything that I was going to try to accomplish as a supervisor. So day one, after roll call, I asked this officer to meet me in private. And he's probably thinking, here we go. You know, this new sergeant comes in and he's already calling me into the office to have a one-on-one meeting. So I sat him down and I said, look, I'm not here to tell you how to do your job. I know that I've got to learn in this new role, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to help me make this transition. So I'm trying to schmooze him into what it is that I'm looking to accomplish and how I could utilize him as a resource. And so he knows the district, you know, the players, you know, the team, and you know how to be a cop. And so I'm looking for you to help me. And so now he starts to get the flavor of what this meeting's about. And his body language changes, his body posture changes, his attitude changes, and he starts to relax in his chair. And we actually had a very good discussion after that. And this officer ultimately turned out to be an asset to me instead of a liability. So, you know, strategic objective number one, check. All right, let's get this guy on my side instead of have him work against me. So in Milwaukee, when you get promoted, you serve a 12-month probationary period. And I ended up getting sent to this 3-week new supervisor orientation that the department puts on, along with whoever else got promoted off of that sergeant's promotional process. I went to this 13 months after I got promoted. So yeah, I'm already off of probation before the department sends me to this new supervisor orientation course. And so you got to consider these things, right? Consider my age, consider my relative inexperience, consider the speed with which I got promoted, you know, not knowing that I'd be number one and not having the time to really mentally prepare for it. An assignment where I'm the only supervisor with a span of control of 18 officers, many of whom were very difficult to deal with. And the fact that it took the department 13 months to officially train me, it's a miracle that I made it through that time in my career at all. And so that goes back to those two pieces of advice, you know, management 101, don't set your people up to fail. I was set up to fail, not intentionally. You know, I'm not blaming the Milwaukee Police Department for it, but that's just the hand that I was dealt. I was set up.
The way business was done.
Yeah. And so I would never, ever want anyone else to have to go through that type of an experience again. You know, that's one of the most difficult transitions to make in our profession, is going from officer to sergeant. I'm not saying that there's not a transition when you go to lieutenant or to captain, but the most difficult one is going from that, you know, worker bee, being the police officer, to now being a part of the department's management team.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's different in every organization. And, you know, the smaller to mid-sized departments, it's one day your coworkers, the next day you're the supervisor. And if you don't have adequate training and an understanding of what that responsibility, what your management responsibility has now become, that can certainly become problematic. And so when you say span of control, I know most people listening to this will understand that, but what the chief is referring to is the number of people that you're supervising at any one time. And national standards will generally tell you that your span of control really should be four, you know, maybe upwards to seven, but that 4 to 7 range, that's about the max that you want to get to. So you're almost three times the span of control that's what's recommended. And why that's important, and that's a lot, because when you're trying to do evaluations for performance, when you're trying to just maintain your situational awareness for a shift of all the things, and that, you know, and that's a busy department, a busy district. Your officers are out there working all day, so and you're responsible for the decisions that they make. So when you say, "Hey, look, I was set up to fail," yeah, you were, but you managed to get through it. And I would say that's not unlike a lot of experiences that a lot of young supervisors have had throughout their career. So it's really something that I think is, you know, when we talk about like this concept of coaching and formal education and formal training, it really becomes critical and for the success of police departments moving forward, is that, you know, individuals really have to be able to manage that stress. They've got to be able to manage themselves. So many things to talk about just and break down just in that, from in the position where we're in right now in America and policing, when we talk about defunding the police, people on the outside, and this is where we go back to those building relationships like you've been doing. If they don't understand the core of policing, then they don't understand the impact that defunding is going to have on an organization. That's never going to make policing better. It's only going to make it worse. And some of the it's like manifest destiny. We think we've got these big issues inside of law enforcement, and we certainly do have some that need to be fixed. But boy, when you cut us off at the knees at that point, now you're really creating some problems for organizations. And rather than defunding, we should be talking about how do we invest so we can really train and educate our, you know, right from day one, from the officer that's coming in the door to those supervisors, you know, identifying them at an early age, getting, you know, and so maybe we consider, the mentor you had that was a colonel, you know, the way that the military sets things up is you go through a supervisor training course long before you become a supervisor. So you have that training. And then when you move into those positions, they'll send you to advanced training. So it's not like you're coming in cold. And I think sometimes we often make the mistake in policing where we have people that are technically proficient, you know, they're tactically sound, they're good police officers, so we make them a supervisor, because that we just make the assumption that they're automatically going to be a good supervisor, and then we don't give them the leadership training and the management training that they need to be successful. And then we want, you know, when they make a poor decision, or one of their people makes a poor decision that they don't address appropriately, We hold them accountable. Fundamental attribution error. We blame the person rather than the system that we have them working in. So 25 years old. So where did you go next?
Oh boy. So worked at a district. I ended up going into a couple of administrative assignments after that. Had an opportunity to work internal affairs, got promoted to lieutenant when I was in internal affairs, went to a couple of patrol assignments, ended up back in a couple of administrative assignments. And in 2008, the department ended up getting Ed Flynn as the chief of police. And I was fortunate enough to work for the first 2.5 years of his tenure along, side of him relatively closely in the office of the chief. Learned a lot. I would say that I learned more in those 2.5 years about how to run an agency, how to be a police chief, than I probably did in my entire supervisory career combined. And I've told him as much. So it was fortunate for him to end up, crossing paths with me at that formative time in my career.
You also said one of the roles that you played was in planning, policy, procedure. You worked with, I think you called it the Office of Management and Analysis and Planning. Is that the same role? Just one of the hats that you wore in that role?
Correct. Yeah, I worked in that role as a lieutenant and as a captain as well.
So that's a lot of great experience that you can bring with you now into the chief's office that you're currently working in. But it gives you a really good opportunity to take what you've learned as a line level officer, as a frontline supervisor. Now you can really begin to evaluate what your policies look like, what needs to change, what's working well. And it also says you guys were doing some work with Comstat. So I know everyone has Comstat looks a little bit different for a lot of people. Of course, the program that was originated out of NYPD in the early 90s, but the that's a lot. Did you find that those experiences have been beneficial for you down the road?
Absolutely. Writing policies and procedures is an art. It's not a science, and having that experience under my belt has really helped me. Setting a strategic objective or a strategic direction for the agency is something you end up getting out of that assignment. Working with, crime analysts for not necessarily the tactical analysis, but the strategic and administrative analysis that goes on, it did help me. And then, you're working alongside somebody that's been in the business for a very long time, and you're able to see how this person operates, what their decision-making and thought-making processes are. And you really understand better how to handle certain situations that you may end up experiencing later on in your career.
Yeah, it's always nice to be able to learn from somebody else's mistakes, right?
Yeah. So, interesting thing is, I take over as the chief here in summer of 2015, and, I inherit an agency where almost every single one of their policies was written in December of 2000. And I went to the deputy city manager, who was my boss, and he was the chief one before the chief before me, for a lengthy period of time. And I said, "How is it that the agency has 15-year-old policies? Almost every one of them is 15 years old." And he goes, "Well, the chief before me was an attorney, so who am I to change what he had to say?" So the first 4 years were really spent fixing that. One of my goals was to achieve CALEA accreditation. And I knew that, this is going to take a while before we get to a position and even be able to be competitive to go through that process. So that was the first 4 years or so getting ready to go through that process. And it took us about 2 years. We achieved CALEA accreditation in late July, this past July. So, did I know then when I worked in OMAP the importance of that experience and how it would help me navigate through a very difficult process in the future as a police chief? No. But that's one of the things that I try to tell my folks is we all need to move around agencies and get a little taste of various aspects, because you can't be a one-trick pony and think you're going to be successful. You need to be a more well-rounded individual. And sometimes I'm going to end up assigning you to a place that you don't necessarily feel comfortable in. I'm going to have to push you into the deep end of the pool and see if you can swim. And if you can't, I'm going to throw you a life preserver. But that's worked out to where, you know, I've got a upcoming mid-level management staff that's going to be the future of this agency that are going to be more well-rounded and fully capable of being plugged into any number of assignments. And that's somebody that's more valuable to any police chief, is if they can be moved around the agency and be effective regardless of the assignment to which you've placed them.
Yeah, and that's easier said than done, right? Because there is a lot of pushback and a lot of resistance to that when somebody thoroughly enjoys what they're doing. But as an administrator, you try to align your people with their interests and the things that they're really good at, right? Because that's gonna impact their performance and what they can do for the agency. But at the same time, you always have to keep your eyes on the future and what's going to be best for the organization. And sometimes when you move people, when they don't want to be moved, that can, and I can say that from personal experience when I was moved from, supervising a multi-jurisdictional narcotics task force to community outreach. that was a bit of a shift. But you know, in the end,
is there a story about what you did wrong to get that assignment at
a future podcast? Well,
it comes down to communicating, all right? Talking to your folks and finding out what makes them tick. What are their career goals and aspirations? And when you have somebody that says, you know what, I want to move up the food chain and someday, you know, sit in the office of the chief, you know, I say, but you can't stay in your assignment then. You're going to have to move around. And you may not like the assignment, but you know what? Do it for a year, year and a half, and we can move you someplace else. And so as long as you're adequately communicating what you're doing and why, and they understand it, there's more buy-in to it. You know, one of my success stories is a sergeant that was working patrol, and I needed somebody to go into our vice and narcotics unit. And, you know, he was a little bit of a round peg in a square hole. And we communicated to him that he was going to go to vice and these are the reasons why. And he didn't go there kicking and screaming, but I'd be lying if I said he went there enthusiastic about, you know, the position. And he ended up thriving and he ended up turning that division around in a positive way. And he's since come to learn the value of being pushed into the deep end of the pool. And I use that as an example to other supervisors about not being complacent and staying in the same assignment forever. And one of the other things you have to consider too, as a chief, is when you have somebody that's in a specialty assignment and they have no desire of moving up in the food chain, keeping them there is preventing somebody else that does have a desire to promote from being able to get that experience. And so that's the communication that you have to have with your management team, is understanding the rationale behind some of these chess moves.
Critically important. And I'm just comforted to hear somebody else say it.
Yeah.
And I know it happens around, but it's one of those things. It's a difficult thing that you have to do as a chief. But for me, again, it was a blessing in disguise. Again, some of the opportunities that you're presented with, I was afforded the opportunity to, work closely with a Department of Homeland Security program at Purdue University, where they were, it was a DHS Center of Excellence, where they were using technology. They were partnering industry and government with technology to create products and things that would help our Department of Defense and public safety employees, you know, keep America safe. And got exposed to a whole level of information and technology that I otherwise would not have, and just developed a real keen interest in what was happening outside of law enforcement from a technology perspective. Again, and I, that wouldn't have happened. You know, the other thing you learn there is when you're working narcotics, you know, any case that you're going to work is all about information. It's about, you know, who's doing what, who's selling what, which houses, which vehicles, which people, And the only way you get that information is through other people, generally speaking. There are some technology things that you can do, but for the most part, it's about relationships and, taking that understanding into a community outreach role, was very, very beneficial. I started to see some things that where we had some gaps we were able to fill. So I guess here, what I'm trying to say for those that are listening, maybe a piece of advice would be not necessarily wait until you get moved, but seek out those opportunities. Make sure you let your supervisors know what your long-term interests are, what your interests in the organization are, and maybe that can help, push you into an assignment where it is out of your comfort zone, but also one that's going to benefit you and also the professional development of your organization.
Yeah, don't be afraid to be placed outside of your comfort zone. You're going to grow, you're going to develop. You might fail at certain things at first, but you're going to be better off in the long term having a greater number of experiences, especially if you're looking to, move up to that, bureau level commander, deputy chief or assistant chief or even the police chief. Is you shouldn't stay in one main area of the department and have that be the entire foundation and basis of your career, because when you move into one of these higher ranking positions, you're going to be responsible for a whole lot more than what you're a subject matter expert in. And I made that a conscious decision to move around from assignment to assignment to be more well-rounded. As the chief, I have the ability to do the same thing with my people, and they understand why.
So the why is very important. It's critical. Absolutely. For people to understand.
Yep.
So, hey, we're getting close to an hour already. I told you it would go fast. So there are a couple of things that I wanted to touch on before we wrap it up today. And it kind of ties into what we're talking about, but I want to go back just a little bit in when we're talking about development and building the future, not just for an individual agency, but for policing in general. The concept of professional development is not new in policing, but I think there are some shortcomings that we have because we've taken a model from, whether it's from academia, whether it is kind of from the military, where we made it our own, and we have this model of train the trainer, which can be financially, it can be very effective because training budgets are not what we would like them to be. We could all, if you give me more, I'll spend more. There's no doubt about it. Equipment. And every agency is going to be a little bit different. So when you're looking at improving performance, you're trying to take your people and send them to training. You're also trying to bring training into your organization, all with the purpose of making your officers more well-rounded, having a better understanding of, and not just about how you might do things within your own organization, but how others outside of your organization are doing things and what you think would work well. The problem with that model is sometimes it information moves through filters, where I take a piece of information and I discard another piece of information, and that piece I discard might be because of my own personal biases or what I think is right, and now my organization misses an opportunity to grab some information that could have been beneficial. Thinking in those terms and thinking about the future of training and policing, what are your thoughts on what we can do as a profession to improve the way that we develop our people? That's a big question.
Yeah. I see AI and virtual reality as being, bigger players in terms of, de-escalation training, shoot, don't shoot scenarios. Not every agency can afford a several $100,000 firearm simulator. So I just see that technology becoming more and more prevalent at a lower cost that can reach agencies that don't have the training budget that they would like to have. I believe in training above and beyond what maybe your state mandates. We certainly do it here. I'm fortunate that we are very well funded. And I know that's not the case in many agencies across the country, but we do invest in training beyond state minimums. We partner with our community college, who in many cases is able to take on the costs of some of the training, specialized training that we bring in. So that's a relationship. If you don't currently have, you know, talk to your local community college based upon the way they're funded. You know, they're motivated to have, you know, full-time equivalents, you know, butts in seats, as it were. And they'll probably either, you know, pay for or at least take a portion of the training costs off of your plate.
Yeah, because if you think about like formal, and we did discuss this briefly, but the formal education process in some states, some communities, a high school diploma or a GED is the minimum requirement. Some organizations have an associate's degree or a bachelor's degree. And you know, formal education is important, right? Because if nothing else, if it's not the information that you're taking with you out of those programs, it's the ability to learn, right? To be a you know, a lifelong learner and to recognize that, hey, if I want to be successful in life, if I want to be really good at what I'm doing, then I have to take the time to invest in myself to develop my future self. And sometimes the organizational challenge is that you have individuals that will always wait for someone else to provide that for them. And then you have individuals that will seek it out on their own.
Unfortunately, not every employee wants to become a better version of himself. I wish that were.
Well, you can't, right? It's like, you can't, the old saying is you can lead a horse to water, right? But you can't make it drink. So, it sounds like Concord is a place where I would want to come work, and you're really looking towards the future. You have a very keen sense of what's important, how to develop people, and then I think, you know, taking that advice that you got as a very, very young officer is don't ever forget where you came from and don't set your people up for failure.
And, you know, we are hiring. We do have some vacancies, so I'll just throw that out there, you know, shameless plug. And just make sure you understand this is Concord, North Carolina, not Concord, New Hampshire, not Concord, California. I think there's like 11 or 12 Concords out there in the U.S. And we're not Concord. You know, we're Concord, North Carolina, and we're hiring. And check us out on our website. And, you know, my information's on there. And you can certainly reach out to me if you want to learn a little bit more about what we do, how we do it, and why we do it.
Awesome. All right. Now, before we close it out, a couple of my favorite questions. What book are you currently reading?
It's called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a F.
I listened to that on audiobook when I was a couple of summers ago when I was sitting at the beach. My brother-in-law, who was an executive for Anthem, he says, you have to read this book. So I downloaded it right away and started listening.
Yeah. So I heard about it from Aaron Rodgers. You know, I'm from Wisconsin, so I'm a cheesehead, and we're inherently Packers fans. And I apologize to those out there that are listening that aren't. But you know, that's your heavy cross to carry, not mine. So Aaron Rodgers had just mentioned it in one of the interviews, and I decided to check it out. And it's a good book if you haven't read it. And it's not about not caring. It's about not being too overly invested in things that ultimately don't matter all that much later on down the road.
Yeah, that is in this day and age, that's incredibly important. And, you know, quite honestly, for police officers, you know, we stress a lot about things that are outside of our control. And sometimes you got to tell yourself, I don't give a,
let it go.
Yeah. All right. What's the most influential book that you've ever read? If you had to pick one book to tell me, hey, you've got to read this book. And I generally tell people outside of the Bible, what might it be?
Boy.
Hard to pick one.
Is it Seven Habits of Highly Affected People? Is that the Covey book?
That's Stephen Covey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that one stuck with me for a while, but I'd be lying to you if I said I had a really good answer for you off the top of my head.
I usually dodge that question and say, well, there is no one book. Yeah.
Okay.
You got to tell me what topic we're talking about. Are we talking about health and nutrition? Are we talking about stress management?
Yeah, so there's really no one book, Patrick, that I can point to.
Well, my book that I'm reading currently is it's Ryan Holiday's new book, if you've never read his, but I pre-ordered it, got the signed copy in, Discipline is Destiny. I'm a big Jocko fan too, so it's, you know, a lot of parallels there. It's an easy read.
So here's one for the audience. And I've read it, I've gone to this person's training, and it's Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement by Dr. Gil Martin. And I actually provide that book to every single officer that I swear in. And we do these swear-ins with their family, their spouses, their loved ones present. And I talk about the importance of picking up that book, not just the officer, but the officer's family, and reading it every once in a while. You know, it's old, but it's still very relevant. I think they're, you know, just came out with another version recently. But every few years, pick up that book, read it. You know, a 30-year career in law enforcement is a marathon. It's not a sprint, and it's more difficult to get through that marathon unless you're reading books like that, and you're making sure that your emotional, mental, spiritual, overall health and well-being, your overall holistic wellness is taken care of. And I don't think we do a good enough job in this profession of making sure that we take care of our folks in that respect.
Well, that is an excellent recommendation. And I don't know that I told you this, but I was very fortunate enough to have the opportunity to train with Dr. Gil Martin. We presented this past February at the National FOP Conference, and last year at the IACP Wellness Symposium. And we did our training topic on the title of our presentation was called The Blood Doesn't Lie. And it was really about the understanding what's happening underneath the hood. Why are police officers dying much younger than the general population? Why are we suffering cardiovascular disease events at a much higher rate than the general population? And Dr. Gil Martin really, you know, he had a bit of a shift from his early days. His core work is still there, but he really started to focus on the physical aspect tied to the emotional aspect, things like how insulin resistance is impacting our health. And so that'll be a good little teaser for a future podcast. So one of the folks that we're going to have on is from Precision Health Reports, Dr. Bill Cromwell and Matt Martin, who started that company. They worked closely with Dr. Jim Greenwald out of Reno, Nevada, and Specialty Health and Precision Health Reports both have these excellent programs for building resiliency and doing lab work. So you'll have to stay tuned for that episode. We'll talk more about why that's important. And but we're over the hour now, I think. So I'll leave it at that. Chief, I really do appreciate you spending a little bit of your time sharing some of your history and the lessons that you've learned, some of the things that you've had success with, and hopefully our listeners will pick up on a few things. If they do and they want to reach out to you, you have a way for them to contact you easily, or how would you like people to get a hold of you?
Yeah, my information, number, and email address is on our website, so it's www.concordnc.gov/police.
All right. So now you know how to reach out to Chief Gasek. So we're going to wrap it up. That's it for today. Thanks for listening, folks, and stay tuned for some more awesome guests here on the Coptimizer podcast coming soon. And that concludes another episode of the Coptimizer podcast. Thank you for listening. And again, thank you for spending some of your valuable time with us. Remember, listening to others and how they optimize their lives is one thing, but to transform yourself, you have to take action. There are different paths to excellence, but to accelerate your own personal growth, I urge you to consider getting a coach. And here's why. While your time is valuable, I also want you to consider something. Your time is fixed. We know how much of it we have. Energy, on the other hand, is not. The decisions we make about how to charge and refresh our body, mind, and spirit will ultimately determine how much energy we have to invest in our time. So, to make the most of each day, we need that energy. So if you're in law enforcement, consider getting a coach and do so by going to axoncoaching.com. Check us out and contact us today. Until our next episode, I'm 1042.